the edge of our hope, at the end of our time. We have chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other. Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
Now get the hell out of our galaxy.
The strength of this starship lay in its diversity.
You see, our glorious diversity, that is not a threat to who we are. It makes us who we are.
You don't just let things happen. You make a stand. You say no. You have the guts to do what's right when everyone else just runs away.
But we must fight this darkness that is threatening to engulf us. Each of us must be a ray of hope.
Rebellions are built on hope.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanti Show.
Love, interstellar war, middle-aged protagonists. You know, the usual.
I'm Jen.
I'm Paul.
I'm Kate.
I'm Alex.
And I'm Stina.
And today we have a brand new show for you all. Hopefully you enjoy it. We'd probably do it even if you don't. This new show is called Reading Rangers. We're going to be discussing Shards of Honor by Lois McMaster Bujold. And over the course of the next, how many books are there, guys?
Lots.
Many.
Many, depending on you count them.
So probably a year and a half to 2 years, we will be discussing the Vorkosigan saga on Reading Rangers. So a little bit back, Paul and I interviewed Alex about their book, Hunger Makes the Wolf. Yay!
Yay!
And during that, we found out that I still had not read any books of the Vorkosigan saga, which clearly was a crime against humanity.
Almost as big of a crime as Batman versus Superman.
which you should go donate to, by the way, so that we have to watch it. So we decided maybe it's a good idea if we introduce myself to the series in a series of podcast recordings. At the same time, parallel to this conversation, Sean Duke has been talking to one of our listeners. He had suggested we do a book club sort of podcast. And so Reading Rangers has been born. So over time, we're going to be doing Vorkosigan Saga. And then after that, hopefully we'll be able to take your suggestions on other things for us to read and discuss on this new show. So we're very excited about it. Thank you, everybody, for being on. This time, we're doing all of us, but each episode will probably have a rotating cast of characters, so to speak, as we read through the books. I have not read the book, any of the books. Stina is coming at this for the first time, although she's a little bit further ahead than some of us. And Kate is also reading this for the first time. And then we have Alex and Paul.
Woo!
Who are the biggest fans ever.
Pretty much.
Well, Lois McMaster Bujold's local to me, so I need to be a fan, or if I know what's good for me.
Oh, well, I mean, I got those books recommended to me for audiobooks because the guy who narrates all of them, Grover Gardner, is amazing. And they're basically like my comfort listen as I'm falling asleep thing. So actually, like, kind of a funny thing is that I've only read one of the books in like actual print format, and I was really extremely shocked and confused by how all of the names were spelled because I've never seen them spelled.
Yeah, I've been listening to the audiobook versions and then going back and then reading the print ones as I go along. So, yes, I understand the sticker shock on that one too.
You're like, oh, so that's how it's spelled. Okay.
So I'm reading them, although my library, the only versions they actually have available are the audio versions. So at some point, I'm pretty sure I will probably listen to them. And clearly, both Paul and Alex have recommended them as fantastic versions of this series. So I look forward to that. And if our listeners want to go along with us, go ahead, listen to the audio or read the book and follow along as we go through this. This will be, for now at least, a bi-monthly podcast, so we'll be doing this again in a couple months and reading the next book in the series, which I believe is Barayar?
Barayar.
Chronologically, not in publication order.
Yeah, we had a discussion about if we were going to do publication order or chronological order, and I came out very strongly for chronological order because that's just how I be.
Yeah, and I think personally that's my preference usually with series. So I think the experience is probably vastly different if you're doing it in publication order. And based on a couple of the reviews I've read, it does sound that way. So it was interesting coming into it through this book. But let's start with, first off, a summary of what this book is about. And we're leaving that to Kate, who cursed her own self by suggesting that we make the new person summarize the book. So, Kate, tell us what this book is about.
Okay, well, first off, I can't help it. Even now that I'm thinking about it, I've been working for 2 weeks to get rid of the idea, but I feel like the Badens are Bajorans, and I forgot the name. The Bar-Yar Empire are Cardassians, so if I slip into that, that's why. I start right from the beginning. I was just like, oh, yeah. So this may have implications for later that you can all laugh at. but anyway, we start off. Cordelia Naismith is leading a somewhat fractious team of scientists on a mostly biological exploration of a new planet that is looking like it's going to be contested kind of based on what they find. When disaster strikes, as she and a small sub-party are coming down the hill, and most of the crew that she was there with is dead or might as well be dead, and really all that she's got left is this, how do you pronounce his name?
Oh, Dubauer.
But he is the team's botanist, and his nervous system is all messed up by, it's not a disruptor, it's a
nerve disruptor.
And our other protagonist shows up, and that is Errol Vorkosigan. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes.
Okay. And he was kind of the victim of an assassination attempt in his own camp. And he's all alone, right? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, he's all.
See, you should have made a fan do this. I make it a big hash of it.
No, I think it's funnier making you do it. So I can just sit here in my little, like, smug, I've read the book a bunch of times throne and just gaze down on you in asshole-like judgment. You're like, oh, it's so cute, you're trying. I'm doing a Gendo Ikari right here.
She thinks Errol's a spoonhead. But, you know, there were some handsome Kardashians, okay? You know, it's not beyond the... Yeah, okay. They have to team up to survive because the Baitons' camp is pretty much destroyed, and all they've got left, as far as foodstuffs, is oatmeal and blue cheese dressing.
Sounds perfectly vile.
Best camping meal ever. Right?
Mm, boy. And they have to make a bunch of meals with that, and Errol doesn't have anything, really, but he knows where there's a big supply dump. Because his people are on the planet too. But it's a long ways away. So he kind of takes them prisoner. But they're really all kind of helping each other survive. And they finally make it back to the Vorkosigan's site. And, or the Bar-Yaren site, sorry. Vorkosigan is his family. And it's kind of like a noble Roman clan, almost like the Claudians or the Julians, is how I interpreted it. That is how is that, Paul? Is that kind of accurate?
There are some notes of classic. It's, you think more like Russian families is really what Busha goes for.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And that the Vor signifies nobility, or is it?
Yeah.
It means that you're warrior caste.
Yeah, it's a warrior caste. Kind of like samurai, but a Russian.
Okay, Russian samurai spoonheads. Got it. I've been working for weeks trying to get that out of my head, but it's just, I don't know.
I'm seeing visions of pitchforks and torches already.
I know, I'm already feeling the hot jabs in my ass. It's like, I might not ever be able to go to a con again. Except nobody knows what I look like.
Just go in like a Cardassian like makeup job and no one will recognize
there
you.
There you go. With a name tag that says Arrow Vorkosian. Oh, and you'll be like, you are, you heretic!
Oh, so much fan rage just from our first episode. It's going to be amazing.
Oh, my God.
Fans, I want you to know that I had nothing to do with this. I am innocent, and so is Paul. We understand and love what you understand and love. Please do not put us against the wall when the revolution comes.
I'm sure I'll get there, because I really loved this book, and I'm down for all of them, and I will learn. But in the process of traveling from the Baiten camp to the Bear Yarn, they've seen lots of terrifying flora and fauna, including my favorite bit, vampire balloons.
Yes!
And yes!
I fucking love the vampire balloons. And Cordelia has kind of fallen in love with Errol, and Errol's kind of fallen in love with Cordelia. But the beautiful thing about them is, even though, I mean, it's obvious that Errol comes from a really honor-based, militaristic, you know, warrior society. But Cordelia has a military background too, and so she's trying to be a professional. Neither of them is really at all forthcoming about their feelings until later in the book. And actually, I was kind of surprised when that first came up finally, as how abruptly it was, but then I realized how perfect it was given their cultures. I don't remember how they get off planet. It's just,
they defeat the mutiny.
Well, why don't I take over then? So basically, they get off planet. I'll rush the last little bit. They get off planet. They each go their separate ways after Cordelia is rescued slash also rescues Errol from the coup that is occurring. And she goes home. He goes home. Some undetermined time later, she is now captain of a ship with a special weapon because the Bar-Yar Empire has invaded a planet system that I'm forgetting the name of right now. Escobar. So Cordelia shows up commanding this ship that is basically a decoy, which allows more ships to come through a jump point under the nose of the Bar-Yar Empire. She is then captured. And then there is a very uncomfortable scene where she is tortured and there is almost a sexual assault by a character whose name I also don't remember right now, but he's evil.
Bothari. Oh, okay. Bothari is not the evil guy. The evil guy is Gesveratir.
He's in charge and he controls Bothari.
Yes, yes. He has basically psychologically tortured Bothari into becoming a weapon. Bothari is actually a character who also figures earlier on in the book. Errol has great respect for Bothari, even though Bothari hates him, and that's actually why they work together somehow. But Bothari has basically been turned into more of a monster than he actually is by this evil Lord Vor guy, who Bothari then kills.
To defend Cordelia.
To defend Cordelia. Cordelia, conveniently, is then quote-unquote rescued by Errol, who shows up right then. Oh, yay! Shenanigans happen, so on and so forth. Does she escape, or she goes to a prison planet at that point? Errol then, because of reasons, because he's been commanded to do so, kills a billion people or something.
I thought that was his backstory.
Yeah, that is backstory.
So then he eventually goes home and is just, he hates his life because he's broken his own code, essentially. He's been ordered to do things that he was not actually comfortable with. Cordelia goes home to Beta, where they then convince her that she has been programmed by the Bar-Yar Empire to be a spy, covert spy. And she freaks out because the Betas are terrible.
And they also tell her that she's been sexually assaulted because of the memory wipe.
Right. They convince her that she was actually assaulted, that her memory was wiped, and then she was programmed to become a spy for the Bar-Yar Empire. And that's the only reason she was allowed to go home and whatnot. They also try to convince her that Errol is this terrible human being, which he kind of is, actually, but with a code of honor, so it's okay. And then she escapes all of that and gets back to Bar-Yar and the love of her life, Errol Vorkosigan, and yay! And then at the very end, they get married and he becomes regent and Botari has a pod baby.
Oh my god! Wow.
The woman that he was forced to sexually assault.
You guys give the best summaries.
Oh my god.
I think I got everything right.
Please tell me we get to see some raising Gazorpazorp in a future novel.
We all miss your reference.
None of you guys watch Rick and Morty?
No.
Oh,
okay. At least you don't have to, you don't, it's not continuity or anything. Get on Hulu and watch the Rick and Morty episode Raising Gazorpazorp. And that's all I'm going to say, because I don't want to spoil it for you guys, but some of our listeners have just forgiven me for the Cardassians.
All right. So let's quickly give our overall impressions. Let's go with Paul and Alex. Overall impressions coming at this from a, I've read it a million times and I just read it again. And then we'll go to Kate, Tina, and myself.
I had not read Shards of On. I had not in a long time. 20 years, I guess. I mean, I known the story because I've been following the Bokazigan saga all along since, but actually sitting down to actually consume the book again, there were things I did not remember. It's like, I didn't remember that, especially Cordelia going back to Beta and it being much more dystopic than I remembered. I was trying to remember in my mind, why did she go to Barya anyway if Beta was good? Oh, no, Beta is actually kind of a dystopic, dystopia of programming and not believing and just believing she was a double H. It's like, I didn't remember that part at all. I mean, I remembered some things very clearly. Their trip across the planet, which is epic and interesting with freaky wildlife and trying to work with someone who's got you captured, but you have to work with them. It's basically the Cordelia and Errol Roadshow, and I remembered that and I loved that. I remembered the funky Baden weapons and the gambits and the nasty stuff on Vorturia's ship, but I did not remember Cordelia going back to Baden and being treated so badly. It's just like, oh my god, now it makes sense. That's why she went to Barriar, because yeah, Baden's not the shining happy city on the hill that I had kind of thought it was, because yeah, because this sort of thing doesn't really get brought up, kind of spoiler, much ever again about what Beta did to her. It's like, wow, holy. So it was, and this is only the second Grover Gardner audio I've listened of the War Causing books. I mean, I've read all the others except for Diplomatic Immunity, which I decided, not Diplomatic Immunity, I'm sorry, Lord Vorpatril's Alliance. Which I decide I will listen to rather than read, just because I had the audiobook and like, wow, this is a really interesting audiobook narrative. I'm going to have to listen to more. I wound up reading Gentleman Joel and the Red Queen rather than listening to it. But when it came time for this and going forward, I'm going to listen to these audiobooks rather than reread them, because this marriage of narrator and work is as just about, I mean, the only thing I can compare it to is the narrator of the Laundry Files for Charles Strauss. I mean, just like this guy gets the author's work and makes it come alive in my ears.
Yes, this is not one of my most favorite Vorkosigan books. The one that comes after this, Barriar, is my second favorite, but I love it because it's one of only two Cordelia books, and I mean, every time I come back to it, I find something new, because I have listened to this book many times. And, you know, this time around, I was thinking of it, you know, it presents a very interesting clash of cultures, because for all that we're like, oh, you know, they're spacefaring and all that, Beta Colony and Barriar have extremely different histories and extremely different cultures, and you really see that in the interactions between Errol and Cordelia. And you also see that, like, in a way, Errol is almost like not even a good example of what Barriar is, because he's sort of like the pinnacle of what the Vor are supposed to be, and most of them aren't like that. But you kind of get into it a lot more in the later books, seeing the comparison of like Bariaran culture, which is quite misogynistic, versus Beta colony. But then Beta has its own problems and how they deal with different problems. And that's really interesting. And then the other thing is I picked up a couple of details that what I love when you go back and you find a detail and you realize that it gets brought up again in a later book. Like this time, there's the brief mention of the fact that Errol draws, which I don't think even gets mentioned again until Gentleman Joel and the Red Queen, but that's kind of a fun thing. And then the other thing is the appearance of the character, for all it's a very short minor in appearance, of Artie Mayhew, who you will see again in The Warrior's Apprentice.
Which one's Artie again?
Artie is, he's super minor. He's at the very end. He's the pilot that Cordelia cons into taking her off Beta colony.
Oh, that's interesting. He comes up later?
Yeah, he has a pretty major role in The Warrior's Apprentice. So it's kind of fun.
That's interesting. Okay. All right. I had a question for both of you then in terms of how this book holds up. Without giving spoilers for later books, which you guys just spoiled everything for me, I'm kidding. Without giving spoilers for later books, how does this one actually hold up compared to the rest of the series?
I mean, it is not one of the best ones. Like I said, I like it maybe more than it really has a right to be liked because I just love the character of Cordelia so much because most of the rest of the series is from her son Miles's perspective.
La 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 la.
It's because she dies. She gets eaten by a vampire balloon. Spoilers. But I mean, to me, like I read these books in such a continuous cycle. Like I never feel like I leave them behind. So it's not a question to me of how it holds up. I think stylistically, it's a good example of kind of how Lois McMaster Bujold tends to build her novels, where it's not like a really strong three-act structure or anything like that. Her stuff is much more like, you know, character-driven, and it's not, I mean, honestly, like, plot structure-wise, I think her novels have more in common with like a romance novel than necessarily like super commercial space opera, because it's very focused on what the character is doing and the obstacles keep coming in and intervening in the character, but you're always very into what is the character thinking, what are they feeling, what are their thought processes, and it's more about what is going on internally with them on this field of, and then all this political shit happens that interferes with the character and they have to deal with it, but it's still very grounded in the feelings and relationships of the characters. And then it's not like it builds up to a giant explosion like the shit I write.
Right. How about you, Paul?
I can see, having reconsumed this, that this is relatively early in Lois's career. I mean, all the things that make Lois very readable are here. They're not quite as polished as they will get. In other words, if you like this, it will get better and much better. Although I could see some of the joints here, I see like, okay, this is early days of her work. I can see that she's laying the foundations for how she writes, how she wants this world, how she wants these characters to work. But this is really setting the stage for even greater payoffs down the line. So this is the appetizer, not the entree in our Bujold course, to be sure.
And was this actually the first one that was published? Or?
Yeah, 1986.
Okay. So that was what I was kind of curious about, because since we are doing this in chronological, not necessarily publication order, you know, as an entry to what later becomes a series not about Cordelia in the slightest bit whatsoever, really. Sorry.
Sorry.
Wait, what's going on?
I'll get over it.
Kate's crying and I don't blame her.
Oh, that's interesting. Actually, the first thing that got published before Shards of Honor was Aftermaths, like the thing at the end of it.
Ah. In like short story form or something?
Yeah, I think so.
Aha.
Yeah, that actually sounds right based on my small amount of research. Okay. So Kate, who is crying because the entire series is not going to be about Cordelia.
I know, it makes me cry too, but you will love Miles. He's super cool.
Okay, I trust.
Actually, I was going to say, Kate, just to give you something to look forward to, a very dear friend of mine who also loves these books calls Miles Space Nancy Drew. So, so now you know what to look forward to.
As played by Peter Dinklage.
Yes, yes, basically.
Okay.
I think you've got me on board.
That cheered me up.
So, Kate, give us your impression.
Cordelia, Cordelia, Cordelia. You don't very often see an unmarried, middle-aged heroine in space opera, in science fiction. And that woman, that kind of person, is going to have a very different experience of all of these elements of the story than, you know, a young ingenue or the wise old crone or whatever, you know, or a man. And so I really, really just attached to her right away. You know, she's 12 years younger than I am or thereabouts, but still, I just got a load of her and I'm like, it me, or at least it me when I was that age and still could do the kind of things that she winds up doing in this novel, like walking across, what, half a planet? She knows who she is. She's got skills. She knows how to do what she's got to do. Love all of that. But I also really loved the way this story, you know, didn't just say, you know, here's demographic X and I'm going to push her through the story. It would be a fundamentally different story with a younger or an older female protagonist, because there were so many attempts to just erase her experience on the part of her culture. Even early, early on, like right after the surprise marriage proposal on board Errol's ship, when he just kind of, it came kind of out of nowhere, but it didn't. And I really liked that because they were both being so duty bound and restrained and, you know, thinking it was inappropriate or whatever. And then he just blurts out, would you become Lady Vorkosigan? And that blew me away, but whatever. But as soon as her countrymen came to rescue her, there was no question that she had been, had a horrible experience and needed rescued. And even though she kind of had to take it over Princess Leia style, which I appreciated. And then she got home and she was gaslighted. You know, I mean, that's exactly, you know, they were just like, no, it's not even, you know, it's not even possible. Nothing that you're saying could possibly be true. You know, you're just a sad middle-aged lady with delusions who doesn't want to deal with what really happened to her, so made up a nice story. And the fact that she survives all of that, and I fucking love her. And I liked Errol too, but for me it was really all about Cordelia. And I get the impression now that these are almost prequels, this and the next book. They're kind of like, well, everyone wants to know about, what's his name, Miles? How Miles' mommy met Miles' daddy, and we have to make sure the story is super awesome. And it totally was. I mean, I had a feeling that Cordelia was going to be my Ned Stark. So it's maybe good to rip off that Band-Aid. I don't know. But that's what it was really all about for me, was just such a great exploration of a character that you don't see every day in science fiction. But it still had all of the stuff you want out of science fiction, you know, and out of a space opera. It had the politics. It had the dynastic intrigues. It had the weird alien life forms. It had the space battles. You know, I loved the tactic with her decoy ship. That whole thing played out so brilliantly. And why have these never been made into a TV show? Hey, Sci-Fi Channel, you know, when you're done with The Expanse.
Just saying.
Yeah.
I'd watch it.
Yeah. And for some reason, I kind of almost pictured Melissa McCarthy as Cordelia.
Oh, totally. I could see that in a hot second. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah. So I'm really... I was torn between diving right into the next one, or I'd just gone into withdrawal after The Expanse was over, and I decided, and I'd been holding off the last Expanse book for a special occasion, so I read that instead, and it was a good choice. But now I'm super ready to dive into the next one and do, but anyway, yeah, it's fantastic.
Good, good. All right, Stina.
Okay, well, this is actually the second time I've read the book. The first time it was based on a recommendation from a friend, and based on what she had told me, she talked an awful lot about Miles and how wonderful Miles was. And so I spent the entire novel waiting for Miles. And he never arrived. So like Gato. So I was really disappointed the first time I read it, and I decided I didn't really care for it all that much and didn't go on. And now I'm glad I reapproached it with a more open mind, and I did enjoy it quite a bit. I liked the whole mutual exchange of butts that happens. it's me and my Buffy quotes. But I was, I love that she's like so competent, you know, Cordelia, and she gets into situations, she makes mistakes, things happen. She does need assistance from time to time, like any normal person would. But she's not this inert thing that gets passed off from male character to male character. So she has her own personality. She makes choices. She has power and agency, and I love that. But the romance completely surprised me. That seemed to like come out of absolutely nowhere. I realize now, because I missed the part, the problem with listening to audiobooks on an iPod is that sometimes if you accidentally brush against the screen, it'll jump forward and you lose your place really easily. So I completely had this gap where they were actually talking about relationships and stuff. So I was like, where did this marriage proposal come from? What the hell?
That's kind of a key scene in their relationship.
Yeah, it kind of is. And so I did go back and like re-listen to it again because, you know, it just seems so out of place. But that's still, I mean, it's really great that she does all the showing and not telling as far as that goes. And I really liked that about it because for me, I like psychological works quite a bit. I love stories that get into characters' heads, and romance isn't the only thing that does that, by the way. Horror does that too, and Stephen King is like all about that. But, alone Shirley Jackson. But they're like all different kinds of genres that actually do crawl into characters' heads. But I've always not, there are certain specific romances that I enjoy, but I don't tend to enjoy romance that much. And I liked that this had a romance that wasn't stereotypical and was handled really well, I felt. And so I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed the fact that she's a middle-aged woman. She's not this absolutely drop-dead gorgeous person. And I like that none of the worlds are perfect. None of their cultures are perfect. They each have their flaws. And I really enjoyed that. The whole time I was listening, and I listened to it like a couple of different times to try to get a handle on this thing. The thing that I found was odd was that all of the worlds seem to originate with Earth. And that all of them have Christian influences in the dialogue as they're speaking to one another. All of them indicate that all of the different worlds indicate that they come from Earth. So, you know, there's the Russian influence at Bar Yar, and I've always felt like Beta Colony was where the feminists ended up.
I hope not, given their treatment of Cordelia, but I see what you're saying.
Well, I agree, but you see what I'm saying, right? My impression was that they were trying overly hard, that they had certain ideas of what Bar Yar is like, right? And they expected her to be treated a certain way by them. And so they had it in their mind that these events happened because they got information from other prisoners who had been abused in that way. And so they just assumed that she was going through some psychological thing, that her memory had been washed out and all that stuff. So I felt like they it's kind of weird that I had this very different impression of Beta Colony than y'all did. I mean, I felt like they treated her badly, but they were trying to mold her into a hero that she wasn't, because they tried to claim that she was the one that killed the bad guy, because she had to take the blame for it, because Bathory couldn't take the blame for it. He couldn't, because he would have been executed. So I just found it really interesting. I also liked that on that multiple genders were being represented, not just male and female. There's a broader spectrum. I liked that too.
Were there? I missed that.
Oh, on Beta Colony. Yeah.
Oh, I don't. It is in the first book.
I believe it's mentioned.
God, I don't remember that at all. I'm disappointed in myself.
Well, maybe it's not, and I'm like on the fourth book or something, and I'm just remembering incorrectly, but I do remember that when they're on Beta, that is actually mentioned. And I thought that was really great, given the time period of like 1986. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One impression that I got of Beta that might play into what you're talking about, Stina, is I kind of almost felt like Beta at some point had been a matriarchy,
mm-hmm.
maybe,
mm-hmm.
and it was overthrown, and there had been some kind of backlash, and they were still kind of recovering from that, and that was why there were so many weird attitudes. You know, they couldn't dial back the whole thing. It's like, oh, you know, it didn't become a Handmaid's Tale or anything, but...
Well, I feel like feminism
is... I'm gonna pause you guys on that, only because I think that this is a conversation that right after my impressions we'll get into, because I think the differences between Bariar and Beta are pretty central to me to this book, and clearly even their relationship, right? And I don't know how it is in the later books, but those differences I think are pretty crucial. And I'll give you my impressions really quickly of Beta and Bariar. As we said earlier, I felt like Bariar was pretty clearly based on a Russian imperial system, and that in sort of counterpoint to that, Beta is very clearly a Western democracy with all its flaws. But it's interesting for me coming at this with our current administration, particularly because they even mentioned at one point, nobody voted for him.
Yeah.
And yet he's president.
Right.
Right? Which is clearly not the same situation we're dealing with right now. The problem was that too many people voted for our guy.
I think the problem was too many people didn't vote at all.
Or didn't vote at all, right. To me, it was very interesting seeing the flaws in democracy, and which I was kind of surprised by, because you have kind of this until, I mean, you are clearly seeing a very critical viewpoint of a Russian imperial system, right, which is easily gamed, has corrupt people in it. Yes, it's based on these very old traditional codes of honor, but at the same time, there are those people, and there are plenty of those people, that are corrupt within that system. And that system occasionally, as the Emperor decides, needs a sort of flushing out to get rid of the bad eggs. But meanwhile, Beta is not... It's a Western democracy, but it definitely has its problems. A, it's trying to create heroes where none exist, because they feel like they need one in order to presumably rouse the public against Bariar, because a war is coming, or a war has occurred, right? So they need their propaganda against Bariar. I see what you're saying about sort of the feminist aspect, but it's almost a critique of feminism, if that's what it is, because it's almost like this is what happens if you take feminism too far. You know, like, they're going to look for crimes where there are none, which I kind of had a problem with in terms of how Beta was presented.
Yeah, I just feel like feminism isn't perfect. And all countries, their politics vacillate between liberal and conservative, right? They all do. If it's a democracy, all right, of any stripe. So I feel like that's just something that would be a natural phase that they might go through and then pull back. Not anyway.
I absolutely don't. I don't disagree with you at all on that. I'll just put that out there. But yeah, so it was really interesting to me to see those differences, and that Lois is actually critiquing both systems. That was cool. I knew on page 2 that Cordelia was going to fall in love with Errol, which I was really disappointed by, actually. I'm going to put that out there because it was so obviously played out. It was so obvious so quickly. And I was like, come on, give me at least a little bit of pushback here. But no, page 2, I was like, okay, this is going to happen. Like, and this is, I know a little bit about the Vokosigan saga in terms of, I know that eventually it's about Miles. I know that there's a Vokosigan. I know that there's a Cordelia. Beyond that, I didn't really know much. So to see the romance happen so quickly and to me pretty overtly, like she gets pretty like doe-eyed about it almost immediately. And he's like this honorable, well, I'm actually in love with you, but I'm not going to tell you about it, except in code, which is their whole relationship conversation. So I don't know, like maybe it's just not my type of romance.
Yeah, I guess it's a little like Jane Eyre that way, because they do talk in code back and forth, which is, I love Jane Eyre. I love Jane Eyre, but...
Right. And it definitely has its, has that type of romance story, obviously, it's a classic, and it's got its place. I just was kind of like, I'm not really digging the sort of Stockholm Syndrome aspect to it, which, to an extent, she pushes back against, but not really enough. For me. And so to me, the relationship was kind of skeevy from day one and not my thing. And then you continue that sort of, though I agree that Cordelia is definitely not a passive character in any way, shape, or form, but you continue that with just, there were so many conveniences in this novel. And I get that conveniences are a good shorthand when you're creating, when you're trying to deal with characters. Paul and the guys talk about this a lot on B5, right? Babylon 5. That things are conveniently happening, because if they didn't conveniently happen, it would take way too long, essentially, to get all this information all in one book.
Uh-huh.
So I get it. I get why it exists as a tactic for writers. But it was too quick for me.
I can see that. But the thing that made it okay is that it didn't just immediately progress into, I love you, we're getting married now. It went to, I don't know, and I'm going to go home. Okay, we'll see you in a couple of years. I'll be thinking about it in the meantime. Okay, check you later.
Definitely. It definitely has its pauses in the relationship. But there's such an inevitability to it that those times apart just seemed kind of pointless. Like, seriously, just get to it. Just get to it already. They get married, and they live happily ever after. The end. Moving on. And I felt like the rest of it was filler in some way, even though they're totally developing a bunch of other stuff. So, other people have hands up right now, and really want to say things. So, I'm going to go with Alex first. Because Alex raised their hand first, so.
One thing I want to point out, and it doesn't get highlighted in this book, but it's there, is one of the big differences between Beta Colony and Barry R, which also explains a lot about the, you know, why gender roles are so different, is Beta Colony had access to the uterine replicator technology. So literally, people don't get pregnant on Beta Colony. They just stick their babies in baby jars. And
yep.
Whereas on Barry-R, they have literally never even heard of that. And they're like, holy shit.
Yeah. That was an interesting development, I have to admit.
Yeah. And I mean, that's actually something you see kind of going throughout the rest of the universe, where how that technology has so seriously affected women just generally, to the point that, you know, later on when they're talking about, like, oh, women who get pregnant with their bodies, that's so unsafe. Why would you do that? So that is kind of one of those culture clash things. And the whole, like, I do want to, I feel like I want to point out with the, you know, the Baton government obsession with Cordelia must have been assaulted and blah, 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 blah. Also consider that from the angle of it being a propaganda piece where they've already told the story to themselves and had the story told to themselves that all of the Bariarans are super fucking evil and they're monsters, and that makes really good press for Steady Freddy and wanting a war, because, you know, hey, like, war gives you a really great popularity bump, apparently. You know, like bombing somebody's country.
The parallels were a little bit disturbing.
Yeah, so for Cordelia to come home and be like, that none of that happened, and what is even going on? Like, that was them being like, no, we've already kind of, like, committed to having this viewpoint. And I think also since this was 86, I think that was when, like, recovered memories and all that were really fucking big.
Oh, yes.
Satanic panic.
Yeah, so I think that's actually also a big part of what we're seeing in her getting gaslit repeatedly by government officials and psychologists, because it is literally a critique of the satanic panic, where she's like, I never got raped, and they're like, yes, you did, you just repressed it, or they've removed it with drugs, or, you know, all that. So that's, I think that's also playing into that, because I didn't even think about that until I was like, oh yeah, that was 86. Yeah, that was the thing that was going on back then.
That's interesting.
That does date the novel in some ways.
Yeah, because I have a feeling if she wrote it today, probably a lot of the political stuff would still be the same, but I have a feeling like that aspect might change.
Yeah, I think so.
That's really interesting. That was actually my last little bit of my impression was, this book is dated. Like, I hate to say it. It's definitely firmly in the 1986 Ban wheelhouse. And this is a banned book, so it makes sense. But I was raised on the Honor Harrington series.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I love it. I know it's terrible and problematic. It's my problematic fave, though. I own literally the entire series. Well, up until like the last five or six books, because at a certain point, you just have to stop buying books, frankly.
You do?
That's a lie. The devil is a liar, Jen.
In one series. That's what I'm saying. There's literally like 50 freaking Honor Harrington books. I had to stop at some point. Especially as I got older and I realized how problematic they actually were. Because, like I said, I was raised on them, and I don't remember when the first book came out, but it's around the mid-80s is what I'm going with. There's something about the language of this book and the style of it that is both absorbing and super childish at the same time. Like, I could have read it as a 10-year-old and been like, cool story, bro, and moved on with my life. Like, there's something very almost YA, despite the sexual assaults and, you know, sort of slightly adult themes. It's, in terms of the actual technical language level, it reads like a pulp novel, which is not to say that it's a bad thing, but that's why I was able to get through it in like 4 hours and call it good and move on with my life, right? So, but I do think there's a lot there, which is why I'm excited that we now get to talk about it, because it's like, especially when you're talking about Beta versus Bariar. So I'm curious, Paul, sort of over time, what you have felt about the Beta versus Bariar. You're the only dude in this too, so like,
I'm a minority on this podcast. Given where the series goes, this is the peak of that conflict as far as Beta versus Bariar, because the rest of the series is going to be concerned with other things as other interstellar entities take much more prominence. The Setagandans, which are mentioned in this book.
Yep.
But you'll see just how big players they are in subsequent novels, that they're really the 800-pound gorillas in this setting. I mean,
are they actually aliens?
No.
Okay.
I don't want to say too much about them. So the Beta versus Bariar conflict, as it were, this is where you most see that striking pose between the two very, very different cultures. I mean, that the beta baiting strain will always be there, even when you get to the Miles books, especially one because of redacted what Miles named that redacted.
You'll find out later. Trust me, it comes up a lot, and especially the fact that Miles is raised by a Baiton mother who is very interested in being a mom.
Yeah,
yeah.
So yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. So I mean, once we get to actually at the last novel, the Gentleman Joel and the Red Queen, we get to see, because that's a Joel and Cordelia book. We'll get to see.
That's right. That is Cordelia.
Yeah. You'll get to see much more the Baiton viewpoint again, and the Baiton versus Barriard viewpoint. That, yeah, it's like when I read that, it's like, wow, I haven't seen this in a long time, and because that viewpoint as expressed here, that conflict between the democracy versus autocracy, if you want to take it in political terms, isn't really brought up for the rest of the series in a large fashion, because there's so many other things in this universe we haven't talked about. And having gone to, I mean, there's plenty more of this universe, and I don't know if I want to tell you to go Google and look at the star map. There's plenty of places in this universe that Bujold will bring and explore and contrast very, very different cultures than Barya or Beta.
So that's really interesting to me, because of the fact that I was getting a very sort of Cold War America versus the Soviet Union vibe.
Me too!
Yeah, I can see that.
And Escobar was like, you know, some little Central European country or South American banana republic. Yeah.
Escobar is actually a super important planet, and it's not like a little republic somewhere. I mean, the other thing to consider, like, with the Barriar Beta conflict, is that conflict is being entirely fostered by Emperor Azar for the purpose of assassinating his own son.
Right.
Yeah.
As soon as his son and all of his cronies are gone, there is no longer any reason whatsoever for Barriar to have any beef with either Escobar or Beta Colony. And in fact, they're just kind of like, we've got a war on a lot of fronts.
That's done.
Because their aim was never to actually take that territory and never to actually have a real war with Beta Colony. They were just trying to get Azar's son killed because he's a terrible fucking person.
Yes.
Yeah, but here's the problem. Like, my issue with the let's kill Azar's son was that I honestly never got the impression that they were doing it because he is a terrible human being. Like, that should have been the freaking reason for killing him off. And yet, it seemed more like, I don't think he's going to lead this country pretty very well. Yes, because he's a terrible human being, but also because he's just kind of an idiot and corrupt.
Actually, no, that's true, because either Azar says or Errol says on Azar's behalf that basically, if we'd thought that he was going to be a competent leader, then Azar would have totally been like, yeah, I guess you can have your own weird torture dungeon, you know? But instead he was just like, you're a fucking moron and you're going to cause another civil war. So we can't have that, which is, I mean, Azar, like, this is the only book where you actually get to see Azar.
Azar is a ruthless son of a bitch.
Oh yeah, no, he's like fucking Discworld patrician veterinary level.
Yeah, but
yeah,
not as
that's
pleasant.
That's a very good way of putting it.
Not as pleasant.
But not as pleasant. And I mean, it's really interesting that this is the only book where you get to see Azar, but as you go forward, you kind of get more of an impression of him as a person just by watching his plans slowly come to fruition over, like, the next 20 years. It's weird.
I can see it, and I look forward to that, because I love the patrician.
Yeah, I actually really like Azar in a weird way, even though he is, I mean, he's a terrible fucking human being, too. Jesus!
That's really, you kind of go, okay, wait, Azar is really freaking terrible. I got that impression really quickly off of the fact that he just killed how many of his citizens just to get rid of his son and his cronies?
That's where I was like, I thought that was one flaw that this book had. I kind of think I needed more than just a, you know, thumbnail sketch of he's a really bad guy in order to justify the body count.
Oh, no. Oh, no. For me, it made perfect sense. It really did.
To me, it felt like the rape scene is that's the villain shorthand, right? Like, this guy is clearly a terrible human being because he's willing to torture and assault women. Even worse, he does it through a by turning a not great guy, but another person into his willing participant, or not so willing, but.
Well, I mean, I get the impression that Verace, once, you know, he's had his fun, he'll like do the thing himself at the very end. But yeah, otherwise he's using Bathory because he's more like.
He's a sadist.
Brain rapey than. Yeah, he's a sadist. He's really gross.
But the prince is who they were killing, and but he never really had a scene where we were like seeing him. You know, he was always off stage.
Yeah, no, that's very true.
And that I found that a flaw.
They make it very clear that the prince is actually an understudy of this horrible, horrible sadist, and that he's been doing the same things over with him. So I think that was pretty clear. But I also liked how, yeah, for me it was, but I liked how the mental health issues were handled in this too, because Bathory, she actually treats Bathory with, because he was never mentally stable to begin with. So this horrible, horrible person gets a hold of this mentally unstable person and then deep stabilizes him even more and creates him into this tool. Which to me was just like, that's, I mean, yes, horrible, horrible rape and torture and abuse and all this other stuff. But for me, the fact that, I mean, just that on top of it was just like, holy shit, right? That's just the worst. But I love that Cordelia had some compassion for him in spite of, I was really impressed by that.
Well, and she read him well enough to realize that his loyalty to Errol was going to be the linchpin that saved her, you know, because she'd seen them together just enough for her to realize.
So I have a question before Alex has to go, because Alex has to leave us, unfortunately. Voyager is the one who Errol had a relationship with before Voyager becomes the evil sadist that he is. Am I correct?
That's correct. Yeah. Errol is bisexual.
Thank you. Okay, good. Thank you. I wanted to make sure, because I was like, that's an interesting counterpoint to this. And
I think he was dabbling in sadism before that, because he does mention that he had certain predilections. So I got the impression that that was an activity that they indulged in, but only so much.
But you mean Errol and Voyager?
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Probably. I mean, Errol had a really bad period in his life when his wife, with the thing with his wife, and that was like apparently partially engineered by Verace. But yeah, I mean, Errol is very explicitly, and this is something that we're gonna, you know, I'm sure we're gonna talk about later, because in the later novels, like it even happens in Barriar, honestly, Lois kind of fucks up the bisexuality thing, because Cordelia's like, well, he used to be bisexual and he's not anymore.
Right.
I'm like, Lois,
right.
That's not how it works.
That's not how it works, right?
Yeah, but, you know, she also kind of fixes it. I feel like Gentleman Joel and the Red Queen is like the apology for that bad moment in Barriar. But yeah, Errol is very explicitly bisexual, and he's actually, you know, on the very, like, prefers men end of bisexual, so it's like really unusual for him to find a woman that he actually likes, which is why everyone keeps being like, oh, you're a female soldier, that must be why he likes you, because you're a mannish or something, you know, Cordelia, who
I noticed, I got that impression, which was one of my I'm going to bang my head on a desk sort of situations for the book,
and I find Cordelia pretty damn feminine, so
right, yeah. If anything else, she's such a contrast.
Yeah.
To, you know, we know he's had the wife, and we know he's had the terrible commander, and we know he's you know, Cordelia's his future. She's such a contrast to either of those that is probably a large part of her attraction, whether she's masculine or feminine or whatever. She's different.
She's very different. She's not Barry Yaren.
Yep.
If nothing else.
It's interesting. So I think we're actually... Does anybody have anything that they specifically wanted to discuss in terms of this book before we close this out? Because we're hitting our hour point for sure.
Well, I'm going to make one quick confession, and that's that I, unlike Jen, didn't really see the romance.
I didn't either.
I was not looking for it. I didn't realize this was an ancestor story. And so I was looking more at the party survival dynamic. The, you know, everyone's bringing something, contributing something. And, you know, she was definitely noticing that he was, you know, nice looking for his age or whatever every once in a while. But, you know, being a middle-aged woman, you know, I'm surrounded a lot of the time by hot young 20-somethings. And I can admire their hotness, but that doesn't mean I'm going to do anything about it. I'm more likely to be like, yeah, back when I was alive, I'd have been getting all over that. But now I know better and I've got other things to do. And so I was waiting for that. So when all of a sudden...
Cordelia don't have time for this.
Yeah, Cordelia got shit to do. Cordelia got a planet to get back to. You know, this is just, you know, a fun little camping trip. And, you know, when Cordelia was young and stupid, she might have hit that. But now she's just like, I can just appreciate it and move on. So when it turned into a romance, that blinded
me. See, I was in the same boat with you. So you're not off base. Okay. That was the same thing I did.
Maybe I'm the weird one. I mean, like, so far, I'm the weird one.
I mean, I can't honestly remember, like, the first time I read it. Like, the reason I actually really like the romance, other than, like, the Stockholm syndrome-y thing kind of makes me cringe a little, though I feel like she establishes well enough that it's not just that.
Yeah, no, agreed.
The reason I like it is because it is this melding of Cordelia being like, I really like this guy. I might be in love with him. Well, I got shit to do.
Exactly.
Yeah. I gotta get home. I gotta go see my family. You're just gonna have to wait, dude. Sorry. We're gonna figure this out like grown-ups.
I think for me, like, the inevitable development of the romance, I enjoyed. Like, the fact that she's like, dude, I have shit to do, and you're a Barry Yaren. Seriously, like, what the hell? The pause button, the big pause buttons that she keeps hitting, I enjoyed. Because she's very practical. She's
so Baiten.
Which I love, right? She's very Baiten, apparently. And so as a character, I was like, this is amazing. But at the same time, 2 pages in, and I was like, God damn it. Like, not again.
Well, Jen, do you read a lot of romances?
No.
Okay. Alex, do you?
I wouldn't say I read a lot, but I will admit that I basically have read everything Courtney Milan has ever written, so.
And Stina, you do, right?
No, I don't. I've only read like a handful of romance novels. I can't. I need more plot than, oh, hi, I like you.
Yeah. And what about you, Paul?
I don't read much romance at all.
The reason I likened Shards of Honor immediately to romance, like, structurally, is because I got that feeling when Cordelia and Errol met. You're like, oh, they are going to end up together, and it's just like, how are they going to get there?
Yes, that's kind of my point. Like, you know it's going to happen immediately. However, it does take time to get to the actual conclusion of that romance. It's just such an inevitable conclusion that I was kind of like, okay. I mean, I went with it. I enjoyed it. But I knew it was going to happen pretty much from the get-go. And I prefer a little bit more of a slow burn, I guess. Although at the same time, Cordelia is so practical that why would she go with a slow burn? That's not her style. It's also not Errol's style. You know, like, they're not gonna dilly-dally, really. I mean, they're gonna hit the pause button, but they're not gonna, like, quibble about their feelings for each other.
They admitted it. And they made plans, they executed their plans, and then she flew and she's like, hey, I'm free now, let's get married.
I loved it, and I would actually love if we have any Arrow listeners out there, what their impression of this was. Because I felt like it was a kind of good example of that, and maybe I'm totally wrong on that, but that aspect I did appreciate. So Alex has to get out of here, so everybody say
bye.
Bye, everyone. Bye.
And then we'll close this thing off in just a couple of minutes. But I really was, yeah. So anything else? Any other final thoughts on this? Any other topics that you think should be explored in terms of Shards of Honor?
I think we did a pretty good job.
Yeah, I think so.
Paul, anything we're missing?
I don't think so. I mean, this, as I said, this is really just the first treading into the waters of Vorkazigan universe. So, do you have any non-spoilery questions for me about how this universe works that I could add that you'd want me to answer now? Or do you want to read the books to find out?
Yeah, I had one question.
Yeah.
Are these planets in the same system, or are they galaxies away, or like how far apart are they?
Okay. So the way that interstellar travel really works in Bujold's universe is basically it's wormholes. It's wormholes
okay, so
between
it's
systems.
Okay, so kind of Hitchy.
Yeah, kind of like Hitchy, kind of like Stargates.
Okay.
So they're all they're
Babylon 5.
or like Babylon 5. I mean, so. And the geometry and the layout of those wormholes is, as you saw in this novel, where they stumble on the same planet, extremely important. Or think of the Molten God's Eye.
Okay.
That's the really good comparison. Like the stellar geometry of how the systems all connect to each other becomes extremely important. I mean, it's important here, but it becomes even more extreme point where we find more systems with their connections to those systems is of crucial importance. So
does it ever get more hard science fiction-y? Some coming from someone who likes, you know, the Alistair Reynolds end of things more than like,
yes. There are planets which go very much more into much more hard, very interesting science fiction and technology.
Well, and I think you kind of get a glimpse of that in this book in terms of the decoy device and the pod babies.
The uterine replicators, yes.
I love the pod babies.
They're pod babies, yeah, Paul.
I love them.
Pod babies.
Gazorpazorp. Trust me, it's Gazorpazorp.
There'll be stuff that make these seem positively pedestrian by comparison. You gals have much to look forward to.
So, and I think Alex touched on it pretty well, the fact that the pod baby technology is something that can absolutely, you know, utterly revolutionize societies. So I'm looking forward to that aspect of things.
I love the way that was handled.
Yeah, it was, well, yeah, again, Botari to me is the most complicated character in this entire series. So, like, I just want more of Botari's story.
You will get more of his background. You will get more.
Which I'm excited by, because he was fascinating, and yet he was the character that I was most conflicted about. So,
understandable.
Right. I mean, he, the whole idea of during his corruption that he had the whole fantasy with Elena, was both disturbing and understandable.
From my perspective, I really felt like he had schizophrenia, okay? And so he was disassociating from reality at that point because he just couldn't deal with all the things that he'd done. And at the same time, his whole sense of right, wrong, and everything, and reality and everything else is just screwed beyond belief. So I really love the way that was handled, because she you can tell that she just, Lois has some sympathy for this guy, even though he's totally messed up. He's very messed up. And that made him a very interesting character, in my opinion.
Broken Bird.
And he's not a character that had to be there. That was definitely a choice to put him there, because the plot would have worked fine without him.
But I love that he's there.
No, I absolutely agree. And I think you're right in terms of sort of the disassociative aspect and the fact that what Elena becomes to him is a symbol of what is right. Despite how he's forced to treat her, clearly, which we don't ever have to see, thank goodness. We know stuff happened, right? And then he becomes a father.
Yeah, and he takes responsibility for it as best he can, right?
Right. It was a really fascinating choice on Bujold's part, I think, in terms of, like you said, the inclusion of the character and how mental illness is dealt with. So I'm looking forward to seeing more of that. And then the second thing is, since I know a little bit about Miles in the later books, not much, but a little bit, is her overall representation of disability in terms of the character that you, the secretary, Errol's secretary at the end, whose name I'm forgetting right now. He is in later books, correct?
Yes.
Okay, just making sure, because I liked the possibilities of where she could be going with that. And I'm hoping for a positive portrayal of disability. And I've heard relatively good things. So I'm looking forward to that aspect of the book. But I think that would be my last little impression of Shards of Honor, which I did enjoy. Like, I've been very critical of it basically this entire podcast, I feel like, which I think is giving a wrong impression of my impression. I did absolutely enjoy this. I think the romance is one of the things that very firmly puts it in my mind into space opera. And as much as, you know, it's a galaxy or universe spanning and technology and interstellar war and all of that cool stuff. But to me, space opera really comes down to those operatic sort of elements, which include romance. And so I really did enjoy it.
I don't see anything wrong with there being romance in things, because that's just how human beings interact with it's just an aspect of how human beings interact. And if you pretend that doesn't exist at all, then I feel your universe and your story is going to lack a certain depth. Not that I feel that every story should have romance in it, but at least people should be aware of one another. I mean, it's possible that you could have a story comprised completely of aces. So that's a possibility, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I just feel like there are certain sectors of science fiction, groups of people that are just like, oh no, we can't have a romance in anything at all. And I'm like, but that's part of human being, you know, being a human being for a lot of people. You can't just pretend that doesn't exist and have full characters.
Though, now that you mention it, if somebody could recommend to me an Arrow Ace space opera, I would actually really appreciate it, because I think that sounds really fascinating.
There's not a lot of romance or sex in the Revelation Space series. I mean, there are some characters that are married to each other, but it's almost an afterthought.
Yeah, that's a good example.
Yeah, and they are stunningly awesome books. I am an Alistair Reynolds fangirl till the day I die.
Well, there we go. I'll have to go check those out. Now I would love, if we have any Arrow Ace, I know we have at least a couple listeners out there, to if they have any other recommendations. But meanwhile, this is a good romance, and it is a very, very, to me, standard space opera beginning. So I look forward to the next book, which is going to be Bariyar. We ready?
Yay!
All right. Bring it.
All right. Well, thank you all for coming on to our brand new show.
Yay!
Listeners, I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did talking about it. So everybody say goodbye.
Bye!
Good night.
Buon noite.
Awkward ending.
And theme. We'll be right back.
thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show, and on Patreon at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. Our intro and outro music comes from The Launch by Chronux. You can find out more about their music at freemusicarchive.org.